Today from the Wings Archive,
Holy Roller, Growing Up in the Church of Knockdown Dragout, or How I Quit Loving the Blue-Eyed Jesus. That's the new book by Code Pink co-founder Diane Wilson. Stay tuned.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings. There's
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
Code Pink is a rowdy, anti-war women's group, and its co-founder Diane Wilson is a rowdy Texas shrimp fisher turned environmental troublemaker. Diane has 5 children, 1 autistic, and she herself was not an ordinary child. Claudia Cragg asked her about that.
It seems to me at that age you were always hiding. You were very shy.
I was very shy.
And you hid in a potato bin.
Uh-huh. Well, I was always trying to find a place to get away from people. And I can remember not only potato bins, because it was very small and you could barely crawl in it, but I would also climb very high in trees and get in the leafiest part so you couldn't see me. And I can remember I would lay in weeds over my head for hours. I would lay in the tide, where the tide starts coming in and it's barely over your nose. And there was a great deal of peace.
And I understand why you hid, because when we first read the first few pages of Holy Roller, we learn very quickly that you shared a bed with 3 sisters.
Oh, yes. 3 sisters. Yes, I did, for a very long time. Yes.
Right. And you were the one who was slap bang right up against the wall, and you wrote on the wall, didn't
you? Yes. I used to write messages, and they were always very spontaneous. I have never been a thinker or a doing a lot of plotting. It was spontaneous things, and it was probably coming straight out of my subconscious. And I wrote, sometimes I felt they were messages from God. Sometimes I felt it was just an observation that struck me. And I used up all the space on the windowsills. And I remember sometimes I even wrote, because I didn't like myself. Sometimes I'd write, I hate you. I hate you. Because I did not like myself. And I don't think that is unusual. I think a lot of young girls, especially in the South, there is very little sense of value placed on women and young girls. And so I wrote all my hidden messages. I also liked being up against the window, because you could be almost outside. It was like almost being outside.
So this lack of appreciation of women that you talk about in Texas was not just from men, though. Your grandma.
Well, the thing of it is in the Pentecostal, there's only 2 ways you can be. You either believe Jesus is the Son of God, and if you don't, it's not because you don't believe it, it's because you're with the devil. But she also was very much a workaholic. You know, she did everything from scratch. She fed a large family. I don't think the woman never stopped working, you know, and she lived to be a ripe old age, about 95, and I imagine she was 92, and she was still heading shrimp, and like I said, and giving every single dime to the radio evangelist.
Who conned her, actually.
Oh, yes. Oh,
and
absolutely.
And your aunties tried to use you
yes,
to spy
yeah.
on the money
yeah.
that Grandma was sending.
Because she was. She was writing all her little checks, and she was sending to those radio evangelists. People believe it. You're talking about the most fundamental belief that they have, that they make sense with their world, and they believe every instance of it. They really do. But the Pentecostal, they believe you speak directly from God. That's the tongue speaking. They believe you can raise the dead. They believe you can cast out devils, because the devils are everywhere, you know, because they're the enemy, they're the evil one, and they're constantly fighting this battle between good and evil with God.
There's a lot in the memoir about talking in tongues, and there's the most extraordinary sequence in the book when your grandma tries to revive Uncle Delbert.
Yes, yes, yes. He, probably the reason why she tried so hard is because he was 18 years old when he was climbing into a boat and he shot himself. And she didn't think he was saved. And so she thought he was going straight to hell. And so she did everything in her power to try to raise him from the dead. And it's in the Bible, and they believe it literally, that if you have the faith of a grain of a mustard seed, and she used to have this little round, it was almost like some kind of a plastic glass, and in it was a tiny little mustard seed. It's tiny. It was almost like a little bit bigger than a grain of salt. And if you had that kind of faith, you could raise the dead. I mean, the miracles that sometimes, it sometimes happens. And she really did. She almost spent 2 days actually trying to raise him from the dead. She had this constant prayer, but she didn't raise him from the dead. And for her, it wasn't because it couldn't be done. It's because her faith wasn't good enough. You know, she always said, if you've got a bicycle faith, you will get what that's worth. But if you have like a Cadillac faith, you could raise the dead.
And Seadrift is a very, very poor place where people work incredibly hard. You're the fourth generation of shrimp fishing, and you yourself have been a shrimp fisher for a long time till you became an activist. But it's part of the glue that sticks this community together was this, or is still, this fundamentalist belief. And your church was the Church of Jesus Loves You, which you call the Church of Knockdown Drag Out Activists. But one of the things I want to talk about that they also believe and you go into in the book is the rapture.
Right. Well, actually, they said CNN and Time Magazine, they took a poll in 2002. And most of the rapture and the details of the apocalypse is in the book of Revelation. And they took a poll and they said 60% of the American people believe in the literal truth of the book of Revelations, believe in that, and that 20% believe it's going to happen in their lifetime. For example, I know like Sarah Palin, she was questioned on the rapture and she said, yes, she believed in the rapture and she believes it will happen in her life because she's Assembly of God. Now, my aunts had moved from my grandmother's faith, which was Assembly of God and Pentecostal, and they had moved into Baptist. And they wore lipstick and they wore earrings and they drank coffee. And my grandmother did none of that. The old Pentecostal, they did not allow lipstick. They didn't allow makeup. They didn't allow jewelry. It was long hair, long skirts, nothing showy at all.
Now, is Sarah Palin someone you admire? You're an activist. She could be said to be an activist.
No. What I had was a certain amount of fear. And the reason why I had fear is because if she is truly Assembly of God Pentecostal, and she, and I know she's very ambitious, I think the Republican Party was impressed with her. There's a part, you know, that she was almost like a rock star for them. And I think she's probably got ambitions to maybe one day run for president. And for a holy roller Assembly of God who believes in the rapture, and to believe in the rapture, you have to believe in the prophecies. And the prophecies is that, you know, that there will be unrest, and that you want unrest because that will bring the rapture. They will even say it is a part of their goals to have a war against Iran. Mm. I mean, they flat state that, a war against Iran.
So therefore, Diane, for you, the prospect of her as a president is...
It's frightening because it's someone who has a tendency, who has some kind of background feelings about bringing on the apocalypse and the rapture. And also the thing that is she was too ready to accuse people of being un-Americans. You know, and to me, that was almost like the next step of saying they were like ungodly.
The Holy Roller gives us this incredible insight to what it is to be a 9-year-old child brought up with these ideas. You mentioned the long hair, long skirt, short hair business, and your dad, Billy Bones.
Yeah.
He had this thing about short hair, didn't he?
He loved, for some reason, he loved short hair on women. And I remember he was always, he wasn't very demonstrative. You know, he didn't show a lot of it. But the only time he would pay me any attention is when he'd say, "I'd sure like your hair if it was cut short." And I would. I'd go cut my hair. He had a particular like for short hair. I think it was the look of it. I don't think it had anything to do about that it was more, definitely not more liberating, because he was very, definitely believed in the old school that the man was head of the house.
And so, indeed, you lived a very separate existence. Your sisters
most certainly
were with your grandma.
Absolutely.
And your brothers were with your dad.
Well, even now when I still go home, like if it's Christmas or Thanksgiving, the women separate, go into separate places that the men do. And usually they always make sure the men are served first. That still goes on.
And also, of course, your grandfather. We read about your grandfather, Chief.
Yes. I think I have a long family trait of dreaming true. And also having visions, because I know my grandfather, he was like half Cherokee, and he could see the dolphins, he could see the fish, he could see the water and the moon, and it was like it spoke to him. And he always had an ability, he thought, that he could talk to the dead, whether it was his dead ancestor or his dead little brother that he called him a sand dune out there, because he buried him out in the sand dunes out there. And even when my uncle died, he felt he was communicating with him. And my dad did. You know, he wasn't, you know, to the point that my grandfather was, but he did dream true dreams, and I most definitely did. And I'm not Pentecostal or a holy roller at all, but I definitely am a mystic.
And you've shucked all the religion like an oyster, like we'd expect a good shrimp fisher to do.
Yes, I have definitely shucked that one. Matter of fact, I felt when I was 9 years old, the route that I was able to cope with it at that age, you know, I developed an alternate personality. I really did. It just took over, and I just kind of pulled back and vanished, and I had this other personality that ran the show. But when I got older, I know, to deal with the whole thing about God, I literally took the God of my religion and I wrestled him to the ground.
This is Claudia Cragg, KGNU. I'm talking with the wonderfully unreasonable Diane Wilson about her new book, which is called Holy Roller. And of course, your first book, Diane, was Unreasonable Woman.
Yes.
And that tells the tale, except it's not a tale, it's absolutely true, about your extraordinary battle in the Bay of Texas and the poisoning and polyvinyl chloride.
Yeah, well, I've been on the bay since I was 8 years old, and I've been a shrimp boat captain since I was probably 25. I've had my own shrimp boat since I was at least 25. I ran the boat by myself, and I like running it by myself. And it was a 42-foot shrimp boat, and I would go out and I would put over a net and I would catch shrimp.
You're a mother of five children.
That's right.
One of whom is autistic.
That's right. They're now from like 23 all the way up to like 33 now. My marriage literally broke up over my activism.
Well, someone appeared with a clipping.
Oh, actually, I had been shrimping for a long time, and shrimping was getting real bad, so I couldn't bring any. You know, I couldn't support the kids, so I started working at a fish house. This old tin building, and it's right on the docks, and all the boats, the shrimp boats, will come up and they will park the boats and they'll unload their shrimp, and I'll take their shrimp and I'll give them ice and fuel. And anyway, I had this shrimper named Bill Bailey, and he had three different types of cancer, and he had lumps. I mean, they're like tennis balls. They were up and down his arm. He just kind of threw this newspaper article at me. It was an Associated Press story. The first time the toxic release inventory ever came out toward the public, it was a bill passed by Congress after Bhopal, India, when in 1984, Bhopal, India had a union carbide plant. And that plant was manufacturing an experimental pesticide. And it did the unthinkable. And it had this like 60-ton release. And it killed
20,000 people.
There's 20,000 people dead. And
still to this day, they are suffering.
The union carbide plant in Bhopal, India is still sitting there. And the contamination, the big barrels of toxic waste are still sitting there. But when that happened in 1984, Congress decided, hey, we can't have something like this happen in America. So they passed the Community Right to Know law. And that said, industry, for the first time, had to report what they were putting out the smokestacks, what they were putting in the water, what they were putting down injection wells, 200-foot deep wells, what they were putting in the landfills. Well, for the first time in 1989, they reported it and it was in the papers so people could see it for the first time. You know, and I'm from a small fishing village. The whole county is only 15,000. We're tiny. You know, I always tell people, we were so far back, Bonnie and Clyde, they used to come down there and hide out. I mean, it's very rural, very way back there, very tiny, and we were number one.
So you called a meeting.
So I called the meeting the first time I had did anything at all like that. And there was such a backlash. The backlash was bizarre because, you know, you're down the fish house and it's messy and it's stinky and you got shrimp juice and fish missing and all over the place. I mean, the first day I had like the bank president. He came down in his suit, his little black suit with his little black shiny shoes. He said, are you trying to start a vigilante group trying to roast industry alive? And I'm like, what? I couldn't figure out what on earth he was talking about.
And what are some of the things people did to you?
My boat was sabotaged twice and nearly sunk with me on it. I had a helicopter land in my front yard. They killed the dog. They shot at the house. They shot at my mother-in-law who had been walking down the road to the mailbox. I know at one time I was doing a demonstration with my children. It was so controversial that people were afraid to join me or be a part.
And also because they didn't want to bite the hand that feeds them.
They had the houses to pay for, trucks to pay for. I had a special relationship with that bay. When, you know, I always talk about that I was a mystic. And I really was. I remember when I was 5 years old and I went to the bay and I could see her. She the water was a woman. And she was an old woman and she had this long gray hair. And I remember she had this long dress that went out in the water. And she had a personality just like my grandmother. And I loved to go down there because this grandmother was down there and she just loved for me to come down there. So you do not forget a vision. So I had to take them on. And matter of fact, there was no way I couldn't do it.
Now, you did take them on.
Yes.
And you were very successful. However, your lawyer, collaborator in activism, Jim Blackburn, settled.
Yes.
And you actually quite seriously tried to take your life. Because
I absolutely did. It was...
He went for a deal that you didn't agree with, and you went out on the boat.
That's it.
And you took a bunch of pills and wine, and the next day you were still alive.
That's right. Obviously, it was not meant for me to die.
But it was bad enough for you at that point to want to
give
up.
That was the worst time I ever went through. It was a strange place because I felt like I couldn't go on. I could not do this anymore, but I couldn't quit. So you can't quit, but you can't do it.
And how long had you been doing it at this stage?
Oh, probably 5 years. And I mean a very intense 5 years. My family had totally pulled away from me.
And your husband.
My husband. We were almost in the middle of a divorce. People crossed the street to avoid me. I would go into a cafe and the woman who owned it would try to shut the door before I even got there because they were, you know, they were afraid for me to be around me.
So what kept you going? Was it your grandmother in the Bay or some Cherokee spirit that you had to keep on fighting?
Well, I think it has to do about my mystical sense. I believe the Bay is a part of myself. And if I gave up on the Bay, I gave up on myself.
And you
see, I think that's the truth. I really do. I think that's a truth.
And you've gone to prison for this.
Oh, I've gone to prison 25 times.
How many times?
25 times. And the longest I've ever been in prison was four months. I was in, whether it's county jails. I've been in county jails 25 times. The longest was 4 months.
And your most serious offense was?
Well, it kind of depends. I have tried to sink my shrimp boat on top of an illegal discharge. I've scaled a chemical tower. I've been arrested a lot for trespass, but it's all for civil disobedience. It's all because you believe what you are doing will cause a greater harm to not happen.
And you believe in interconnectedness, too.
Oh, I absolutely believe it. You know, I don't tell anybody who works on the Bay, because you're out by the water and the waves and the moon, and it's just, there's no boundaries. There's no boundaries.
And equally, there's no boundaries between you in Sea Drift and Indians in Beauport.
That is exactly right. And I think this whole ideal of a boundary is an illusion. And as a matter of fact, that's why I even sometimes have a beef about people's sense of nationalism or patriotism, because you start separate. It's a boundary. You know, it's like, I'm only this and I'm no further than this. And then it's so easy to do harm to them or cause a war or invade because they're the other and they're not a part of me.
Who first accused you of being an unreasonable woman?
I did it myself. I saw a quote from George Bernard Shaw, and he said, and actually he was saying it about men, but I just took it and made it about women. And he said, reasonable women adapt to the world, and an unreasonable woman makes the world adapt to her. And therefore, all progress depends on unreasonable women. And I was like, I agree with that. I believe in it. And I think we are too well-behaved, and we need to be unreasonable. And so...
And so, Code Pink, you started, co-founded in 1992.
That's right. And, I gave a speech about unreasonableness. And because of that speech, and it was in California, and, you know, you'd think California women don't need to be encouraged to be unreasonable. The idea you have about them is they're already out there. And when I gave that speech on unreasonable women, I had all of these California women coming up, and they were literally crying and saying, oh, you don't know how good I felt about you talking about being unreasonable. And I was like, maybe what we need is a movement of unreasonable women. And so I talked to Kenny Oshville, who's the founder of Bioneers, and I told him this idea, and he and his wife, we got like 32 of the most radical women in the country, and we went to this little canyon in California and talked about what it would be like, how could you do it, how would you do, and pull together a movement of unreasonable women. So while we were discussing that, I remember someone said, well, what are we going to do about the war in Iraq? And, you know, me, and I'm a big-time hunger striker. I've done a half a dozen hunger strikes already. And so I said, well, we're going to do a hunger strike in front of the White House. And so we did. We took a hunger strike, a three-month hunger strike in front of the Lafayette Park, in front of the White House. And we didn't have a name. We were just some of the women of unreasonable women. And there was, you know, it was a very high alert, code orange, code red, code this and code that. And as a joke, we said, we'll call ourselves Code Pink, you know, and we will take back the color pink, because we felt it had been contaminated with this girly idea, and we would make it a powerful woman sign. And so we started calling ourselves Code Pink. Before the war began, right after our hunger strike, we went to Baghdad. Just, matter of fact, as the human shields were coming into Baghdad, we went to Baghdad. We were there about a week and a half, and we wanted to give them the message that even though there was a potential threat from the government that they were going to invade, that all the American people did not feel the same way. And that was our message. So I don't think there has been a anti-war group as persistent as Code Pink has been in Washington, D.C. And matter of fact, we have probably did at least three major hunger strikes to stop the war and bring the troops home. And God knows how many times we've been kicked out of meetings and hearings. And matter of fact, I remember when Rumsfeld was delivering his first speech before the Service Arms Committee about why we needed to invade, and we disrupted him. We were right behind him, screaming our heads off.
And presumably you're not going to give up now.
No. Code Pink is one of these organic, growing women's grassroots efforts, and it's just the beginning. To me, it's just the beginning.
In Holy Roller, we read about your most formative years, and we've just heard what you are now and all this activism. So from this evangelical fundamentalist base to this passionate activism, it seems that there's been a morphing of the two into an incredible force.
Yeah. Well, I believe the thing that remained with me, even after I gave up my Pentecostal religion, the thing that remained with me is a firm belief in the invisible world. And I think there is an energy and a connectedness with it. And I believe that it is alive and that you can align with it. I go to a lot of environmental conferences and they talk about the environment. You know, it's easy to throw the word environment and they talk about it's alive and it's that. But the thing that is they don't treat it like it's alive, because if you treat it like it's really alive, you will know it has an energy that you can align with. But it's very, you know, it's very spontaneous, and it's sometimes it's unreasonable, and sometimes it's illogical, and it's not linear. And that has been a mark of my activism, because I will many times do an action and I have no idea yet why I'm doing it. And I won't know maybe sometimes months later, but it's a trusting and aligning with that invisible universe. And that's why I'm a mystic, and that plays well into my activism.
Well, Diane Wilson, I know that your mama says that you will go to hell for writing Holy Roller.
Yes, she does.
But I thank you very much for talking to KG and you. Holy Rollers is a wonderful, wonderful
thank you.
Memoir.
Thank you very much.
I highly recommend it. Thank you so much for talking to
us
today.
Thank you.
Diane Wilson's book, Holy Roller, is published by Chelsea Green in Vermont. She's the co-founder of women's anti-war group Code Pink. Her first memoir was An Unreasonable Woman. Thanks to Claudia Cragg of KGNU for sharing this interview with Wings. You can hear Wings programs again in the archives at www.wings.org. Our supporters include your local radio station, Suzette Cullen, and Genevieve Vaughn, author of Forgiving, A Feminist Criticism of Exchange. The Wings sound logo is from Libana's album A Circle is Cast. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.